Gurbanazars, for inviting me. I kind of arranged with Jonathan that he would be a bit more general about these models, because we actually worked a lot together, so it was a bit difficult to separate things. So the idea is that I'm going to go through the construction anyway, even if I risk to repeat some things, and hoping that the repetition will clarify some issues. But at some point, I was specialized in the Lorentzian theory. And that because, well, anyway, we hope that the Lorentzian theory is the good theory for relativity. So here's the plan. I'll go through some introduction. I'll define the lattice theory, go through the spin form quantization, and so allowing me to define the model that you're proposing for spin form gravity. And then I'll finish with some perspectives. Okay, so just a very broad view of the subject. What do we want to do in principle? So we want to define a state sum model for gravity. So what is a state sum model for gravity? It's supposed to be a discrete version of the path integral for general relativity. So what you do is that you choose a certain triangulation delta. And after some manipulations, you want to write it with a very simplified set of amplitudes, which is to each subsimplex of this triangulation, you associate an amplitude. So for an edge, for a face, and for a vertex. I'll go through the construction a bit, be more clear in the middle of the talk. So the original motivation comes from the quantum gravity. So we want it to be to define a projector on physical states of the canonical theory. Another, so all of it is, so as we were talking before, all of this is model building. We allow ourselves to be open-minded in some points of the construction. But at some point, we want to check that we really have GR, we really work on GR. So one of the criteria we want to ask is that at the semi-classical limit of these models, we find the radiation. So after that, what you want to do is eventually define some observables. So we're going to talk about propagators, which are endpoint functions, geometric operators, and eventually something like particles. And eventually, what one really wants to do is to get rid of this triangulation. But I won't talk about that in this talk. Okay, so a bit of history. So for quite some time, we were very happy about a model called the Barrett-Penn model, defined by these people here. And the reason why we were happy is that, so first, it does contain the radiaction in the semi-classical limit, as has been shown by these people here. And so if one tries to find the graviton propagator in this setting, one does get the right behavior for some of the components of the graviton propagator, as has been shown by these people here. So we were happy, but we were also doubtful about some topics. And I'll go through them. So the first thing is related to relation to loop quantum gravity. So as we want it to be a projector on the physical states of the theory, we would like to have the kinematical states, right, to start with. And the fact is that, so I'll explain it a little bit better at the end of the talk. So the fact that for the Barrett-Penn model, we don't really have this, the right spin networks, as Jonathan has defined. And this structure is a little bit more complicated and has been defined as projected spin networks by Eta Halivin and Sergei Alexandrov. So a second source of concern came from the non-diagonal components of the graviton propagator, and it turns out to come out wrong. And I just want to advertise that, so I'm a bit in advance here, but there is a paper coming on and saying that the new models do get right non-diagonal components. So it's coming out soon. So a third source of concern comes from what's called the ultra-locality of the geometry of these models. So this has been advertised by Laurent Fadel and Kirill Krasnov. And it is that the geometry that you get from this semi-classical limit, this Reggie geometry, it is a Reggie geometry, but it's a little bit weird, as has been noticed by Barrett in this paper. And it's weird because if you have two four simplices and want to trade them between these four simplices, the geometry seen by the two four simplices is uncorrelated. So you can have a tetrahedron seen by one four simplex, and you have some areas. And on the other four simplex, you have different areas. They don't have to be the same. So the geometry is somehow uncorrelated. It's not propagated correctly. And finally, the mesoperimeter, as we were discussing, it has not been completely correctly implemented in this context. So, and it has been, there has been an attempt by Peta Halvin and Daniele Orizzi to come around this problem, but it's fair to say that it's, it has been an open problem until now. So the strategy here will be the following. We'll first tackle this last issue and start to implement the mesoperimeter from the start. And it is more or less, so the problem in loop quantum gravity we were talking about, if you don't solve the mesoperimeter, you don't have a TF connections, you don't have discrete spectra, you don't have anything. So we hope that by introducing the mesoperimeter from the start, we somehow will be able to solve the first problem, so get the right kinematical states. And then we'll see that for free, we get the geometry right. So this was not the original motivation, but it does come out right, as has been advertised by law. OK, so the classical theory. So John, I'm going to be fast here because Jonathan has talked about that. So we work with a Clebsch-based classical theory. It is a BF theory, and we allow for the Hose term. And so it's a BF theory with some constraints imposed by these Lagrange multipliers. And the reason why we like it is that we know how to quantize BF theory non-perturbatively, and we hope that that knowledge will allow us to quantize gravity. Okay. So we discretize it. We have four simplices, tetrahedra, and triangles. And do also on the, and we actually look on the dual triangulation, so vertices, edges, and faces. So the lattice theory here is based on these papers with Jonathan Engel and Carlo Ravelli, but it's strongly inspired by the work of these people here. And so you discretize it, as Jonathan did. So we have B variables on the algebra of the Lorentz group, and anomalies on the group constructed by following the following scheme. So this is a face. You have a vertex, a link of vertices going around the face. And you break that face in small pieces that we call wedge. This has been done by Michael Rosenbergen. So the variables are so the B on that face and an anomaly per half edge. So this is the BF theory. You want to discretize the simplicity constraints too. So as Jonathan was explaining, you have three sets of simplicity constraints, the diagonal ones, the off-diagonal, and the dynamic ones. And so the strategy to deal with these constraints will be we forget about the last ones. And the motivation is the following. So we can see that if you also take care of the closure constraint, which is just a Gauss law for BF theory, and if you are in the Reggie geometry, the last constraint is automatically satisfied. So what you're going to do is that we're going to forget that for the moment. And at some point, we need to check that we really, you're really picking on Reggie geometries. And so actually, the results on the semi-classical analysis by Conradi and Fredel actually show that the potential function peaks on these red geometries. So even if you forget about them at this classical level, you're going to recover it on the dynamics. So it's, you're not losing too much information. And so we have to do with the first two. And so we do this by reformulating the simplicity constraints, as Jonathan explained us, as a linear constraint. So N is a normal on the internal space to each tetrahedron. And you're forcing the bivectors to lie in a three-dimensional hyperspace. Okay. So this is the classical theory. The quantization goes as following. So this has been defined a long time ago by Oguri and revised by Baez, who was actually the one who gave the name spin foam. So what you do is that you discretize it naively and integrate over the B fields, and you have a product of deltas on the alarms. This tells you that the PFTU is just a theory of flat connections. And to get the state sum order that I wrote you before, you just have to write the deltas in, expand the deltas in characters, and do a little bit of algebra, and you get the state sum order. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to keep the integrations here. Okay, so we have the free theory, you have to project it to the constraints, the solution of the constraints. So here's the face, and you're going to impose some projectors on each edge. So these projectors will impose the simplicity constraints, which are the constraints of PU, GR, instead of BF. Okay, so that's, so this is the scheme. Now I want to go through explicit expressions. And to do that, I need to a small slide on representation theory. I'm sorry for that. I have to do it. So the Lorentz group, so the unitary representations of Lorentz group are given by, are labeled by two numbers, an integer and a real number, n and ho. These are the Casimirs. I may use the boost and the generator and the rotation generators. And this is the Casimir of an internal SU2 subgroup. So the composition in SU2 reduced is given by the formula. And so what's going to be particularly useful for us is what we call the canonical basis for the Lorentz group, which is just a basis that diagonalizes simultaneously these operators. So the two Casimirs, the SU2 Casimir and the Z direction. So given that basis, and we want to impose the constraints. So choose a gauge fixed form of that constraint, as Jonathan explained us. So actually, for the Euclidean case, it doesn't hurt to do that gauge fixing. In the Lorentzian, you're actually choosing space-like triangles. To do time-like triangles, you need to do another gauge fixing. So you write it, and as Jonathan, so I'm sorry to go, I'm going fast because supposedly we saw that already. And so you write this master constraint as defined by Timan and Dietrich, and what paper where it appeared. So this formulation of constraints as a master constraint was a paper as Jonathan last year. Okay, so we have everything we need. The action of this master constraint on this canonical basis is given by that expression. We can see that it's a sum of two positive terms, which we were what we were expecting. So we can read the solutions from that. And the usefulness of this canonical basis is just that the solution is just a subset of these basis. So it's given by relating this SL2C representation we're living in to a certain affixed SL2 reducible. So this allows us to define the projector we were looking for, and it's just that. Yes.
because this is a key point. So you have all the representations of the Lorentz group, which are unitary, and they're infinite dimensional forms there, right? Right. And then you impose your constraints, the result of composing, you can, and they're labeled by some real number in a spin, in an SU2 spin, and
yes.
Then the z components. Okay.
Yeah.
So the k is like an SU2 spin.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a half integer.
It's a half integer. And then you discover that the solution of your projection operator, which implements the constraints and takes it from a topological field theory to quantum general relativity, is this, no, the states are labeled just by a spin, not by a continuous variable, and the continuous variable is has the emergency parameter. So is this now a finite dimensional representation of this? I mean, somehow you can make, now you can make a correspondence to this, to the SU2 spins, which are finite dimensional. Can you deal with the case where gamma is complex? We didn't tell people that the emergency parameter can become a complex number and have a phase. Can you, is that, are you assuming it's real?
I'm assuming it's real, yes.
Yes.
But because it's complex, I think I will.
When it's complex, the boson bracket structure is complex. You can't quantize complex boson bracket structures. Because the commutators for quantum theory always satisfy a certain relationship with the Hermitian conjugate, which is not satisfied by a complex boson bracket. So you don't even know how to canonically quantize it.
Okay, so you're in, good. So you're
yeah,
in a real.
You don't really need to talk about canonical structure here. But this way of saying we really don't need to talk about canonical structure. So I guess you could try to define the model. And I don't know what happens. I'll try.
Okay, we can talk about it.
Okay, so this is essentially the model. Before going to a more explicit form, let me analyze some special cases. Okay, so first thing is that I told you I spent one slide talking about how the Barry claim was bad, and I didn't even define it clearly. So with this technique, I can actually define it. So it can be seen as a limiting case for gamma infinity. So if you remember the expression before, it reinforces the SU2 space where you're living to be exactly the invariant subspace. Yeah. So with this projector, what happens is that you really have a sum, you have one state, it's the invariant subspace. So that's it. So you're seeing that this limiting case is a bit strange because first you lose that SU2, you lose the freedom that you have in the, so if you break for simplex by for simplex your translation, you lose that SU2 structure that you had. Also, you can write like that, you can write the amplitude, the full amplitude as really individual amplitudes per for simplex. So you lose this, you won't correlate as a stop normal. You won't correlate this amplitude. So this is what I was talking about. So actually, so you lose this spin, you lose this the SU2 spin network structure, but you can actually define a projected spin network as given by this before. And I just want to mention, without going into the details, that so in this paper, Fedele and Prez now define a Gaussianized version of this limiting case. So you do get a boundary structure, even if it's not still as true, but you do have a larger, a richer boundary structure. Okay, so another interesting case is what you call the flipped case. It's for gamma going to zero. So actually, historically, that was the first model we defined. And for the Lorentzian case, that's appearing in that paper. And so it has only the nice properties of an SU2, spin-like structure, and correlation between two neighboring first instances. And if you look at the classical continuous action the gamma equals zero case is actually we're selecting only the host term. So we may argue that this is related to the topological sector of the theory, or the visionary sector of the theory. But well, this is something to be checked. Okay, so I can go to the vertex amplitude. So if you do that piece of algebra, so expand the deltas in characters and so on, you write that state some model. And this appeared in this paper, Jonathan Engler, Pocahontas and Cavallarelli. The vertex seems complicated, but actually it's not that complicated. It's just a 15J of the Lorentz group. And with certain choice. So you can see this is a certain choice of edge amplitudes or a certain choice of interferers. Okay. And so this F is really a map between an SF2 interferer and an SF2C interferer. Okay. So the vertex is well defined, only that it's not. So the only thing you have to take care of still is the non-compactness of the gauge group. It's nothing. So this is something we did with Jonathan Engel this year. The procedure is much the same that Baz and Barry did for the Barry model, and it goes as follows. So the variables we have to, so the infinities come from the integration of these variables. And we want to try to gauge fix it as in lattice gauge theory, we gauge fix a maximal tree to the identity. So the gauge freedom lies on the vertices of the graph. So the real vertices and this edge vertices that you have to write to construct the model. And what happens is that, so here you have an SF2C gauge freedom, but here because you're projecting, you have an SF2 gauge freedom. So you don't really, you can't really go through the whole thing. The maximum you can do is fix one small g per vertex. And that's what we did, and one can show it's finite. So this maximal tree prescription has it explained in that paper for case of 3D VFT. Okay, so how much time? So this is the state sum model. As I told you, now we want to do something more of that. So can we define observables? Can we extract some physics out? So the first thing we can do is define error predictors. They're very naturally defined in this context. And so classically they're defined by, so the error squared, which is just the square of the B field. And so if you go through some algebra and impose the simplicity constants, what you get, as Jonathan was telling us, is that the errors are proportional to the SF2 chasm. So the moment we found it, we were very happy. First reason is that this draws a connection with the quantum gravity, which is much stronger than only as a morphism between boundary states. It really, you can define the theory on similar boundary states, but you can also define observables that have the same spectrum. So this is much stronger. And we're actually happier than that because remind that this is already some theory. So it's not trivial to get discrete spectrum from a Lorentzian theory. In fact, it has been advertised for quite some time, for instance, by Sergei Alexandrov and other people, that the error spectrum in the DC model would be continuous because it did not have any discrete variables to play with. So this is really a non-trivial result. So this is essentially work done, and let me go through work in progress. So another thing you can try to couple what you want to couple is particles, actually. But in Blavatsky theory,
And it differs a couple particles because even you don't have tetrads. That's the difficult part. What you can try to do is a couple strings. So this is these couple of strings to be F2 has been introduced by Bayes and Paris. And so they're not really real strings, they're just flat strings and they don't have real dynamics. But so what Winston Fairbairn has shown this summer is that if you impose the simplistic constraints to that action, you find a relation within the Mugoto action. So what you're trying to do is to write the spin form model for that. Bf plus constraints plus strings and see how this. So the same classical lab you can see it should work, but there's still details to be checked. Okay.
And you're not going to tell us what SW is?
Hmm?
You're not going to tell us what the.
Yes, it's.
What? The string action.
So it's essentially integral on the worksheet of the trace of the B field times a fixed. Well, you can. Essentially that without going into the complications. So this chooses which kind of representations of such a series. If it's time like, you know, or there. And this is a true form, and it's a zero form of the algebra.
And that gives the natural growth line.
Yes, that's the result of constraints. If you impose the simplicity constraints. Right. And depending on which type, you get the Mugoto action for tachyons, for no particles, or for real particles. Okay, so. Almost done. So I want to emphasize that this has been defined for triangulations which have only space-like triangles. So this is really, if you look from the canonical theory, it's really what you want. You want something that evolves in time. But you still want a more general definition. It shouldn't be too difficult, but it has to be done. And so another thing is, so this summer, some nice results on the same classical limit of the Euclidean models have appeared by Conradi and Fredel, and also by Farrell and other people in Nottingham, and trying to do it for the LPG vertex. And so as I told you, it has a nice interpretation, has a nice connection for edge calculus. And what we're starting to do is the same thing for the Lorentz models. Okay. And, so as I told you, eventually what you need one to take care of the triangulation, and so this is really an open problem for me. It's something that I want to start to work with now. It's how to define even a continuum limit, or find some sort of fixed point on a renormalization group flow or something like that, and eventually get contact with concepts of different variants in that form. Okay, so that's it.
Questions? So you want to get more a continuum limit, whereas Jonathan was saying that he seemed to say he wanted to get more of a discrete action. So why do you prefer having some sort of continuum limit?
Well, you can get a discrete action, but then I mean, you do have a continuum action at least for the given models. But then, well, these are discrete action for fixed relations. So discrete action is just a step for the continuum limit, in my opinion.
Okay, if there are any questions, I'll try to be the bad guy here. So if these have approximations to them which are regicalculus, But there's a big literature on quantum Reggie calculus, and there are terrible issues with quantum Reggie calculus. The pattern interval doesn't make sense, then diffeomorphism variance is not realized, etc. So is it a thing that, is it a good sign or a bad sign that there's an approximation which is quantum Reggie calculus? Maybe it's a bad sign.
Well, the approximation is in the semi-classical limit. So, any theory of Reggie calculus in the semi-classical limit, but it's different in the, when you allow, the moment you allow fluctuations. So, maybe it's you can see it as a better definition of Reggie calculus in the quantum region. So, how do you expect these theories to be better behaved when you go around, when you go away the semi-classical in the stationary point?
So in the quantum region. Okay. So related to that, there were some other good properties of the Farrell-Cray model. And I understand the properties that were bad, but there were some good properties. So are they still preserved? For example, the Farrell-Cray model was ultraviolet finite phase. You put on an infrared regulator, then the Farrell-Cray model's path intervals were convergent. In fact, they were very, very quickly convergent. So there were some strong results about ultraviolet finiteness. Are those results still going to be true again?
They were. So the finiteness of the Farrell-Cray models were proved certain choices of measures, of right. Edge measures. And these choices are not, well, maybe they're not completely well justified. You have an ambiguity in the finite. At least for the Farrell-Cray model, certain these edges, these edge amplitudes. And so you have actually, maybe by Bolivar and Paris, that argue that actually the finite models are not fully physical. You need some infinite. You don't want a very finite model, you want a critically finite model. It's, so I would say here you can choose some agents that will make them to be finite, but I'm not sure they're physical.
Okay, I mean that's a. So you're saying that some people are arguing that you want a critical point, so you want ultraviolet scaling rather than just ultraviolet.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's a it's half a philosophical and half a scientific question. And we can argue about.
Okay.
Other questions?
Thank you.